the House Committee on Rules, Elections, and Public Affairs order. I'm going to start with a public hearing on SJN 12. Representative Jensen? And can we have a staff report, Judith?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, SJN 12 urges Congress to direct the United States Army to negotiate moratorium of agreement with Morrill and Umatilla counties to provide funding for cost of incinerator at Umatilla Chemical Depot.
Thank you. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, wish you all a good afternoon and appreciate the opportunity to be here to present SJN 12 to you, bring it to you, and ask for your support of this measure. SJN 12 has to do with the Umatilla Chemical Depot, which is in a U.S. Army installation located in northeastern Morrow and northwestern Umatilla counties. The Umatilla Chemical Depot stores two types of deadly nerve gas, VX and GB, and one type of blister gas, HD, commonly known as mustard gas. Due to international treaty, the United States Army is required to destroy these chemical weapons. Currently, an incinerator is being constructed in the chemical depot to incinerate chemical weapons. Construction will continue through the year 2000. Operation is scheduled to begin sometime in 2001. Should end somewhere in the neighborhood of the year 2006. The incinerator is then scheduled to be total and completely dismantled in an agreement that was reached in the area with the state of Oregon, between the state of Oregon then and the Army. This eastern Oregon community has been through booms and busts associated with federal projects in the past. These include the construction of the Army Ordnance Depot during World War II, the Navy bombing range, and the federal dams, especially the McNary Dam located along the Columbia River. When these projects were finished, the local community was left with unfunded problems and damages, including removal of land from its tax base, lost opportunities to attract other industry due to the presence of chemical weapons, and declining populations and deteriorating temporary worker housing. Once again, these two communities are bearing a disproportionate share of the cost of a federal project that is mandated by international treaties. The building and operation of this incinerator is a federal action that has adverse local economic and potential environmental consequences that are not being mitigated in any fashion by the Army or in any other federal agency. In brief, the building, operation, and dismantling of the incinerator will impact the local infrastructure, schools, special districts, general local government operations, housing, environmental and quality of life, as well as lost economic opportunities. Even now, one local community, Irrigan, is being torn apart by this sudden economic growth that is present here. While I'm not going to detail all of these impacts, I would like to mention that one of the heaviest burdens will be the construction of single and multifamily housing. A recent study in Oregon showed that for every new single-family home in a community, the average cost in the public infrastructure alone, no human service costs, is $20,000 per home. There are approximately 850 construction workers, and there will be an estimated 815 workers once the incinerator is completed. Even a portion of such a large workforce is difficult to absorb in a rural economy in a short period of time, given the limited infrastructure and current social and demographic challenges. The financial impact to public infrastructure and services alone in Morrow County is estimated at $20 million. At the same time, the United States Army is not required to obtain land use permits for construction of the incinerator or other activities. Moreover, Morrow and Umatilla counties are entitled to are not entitled to property tax revenue and has not collected payment in lieu of taxes from the Army throughout its history there. In addition, the contractor building the incinerator is exempt from corporate and property tax since the incinerator is a federal project. Finally, this bill is not setting a precedent. The precedent was set by the United States Army when it gave Tule County in Utah $13 million for impact fees from the Tule Chemical Agent Disposal Facility that was constructed and is currently in operation there. That is a facility which is basically handling the same problem, same chemicals that they will be processing at Umatilla. In the interest of fairness as well as some necessity as far as these counties are concerned, I urge your support of SJM 12. And at this, I'd close and be willing to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. Any questions for Representative Jensen from the committee? Seeing no questions. Thank you, Representative Jensen, for your time this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm privileged to be here, and thank you for your consideration.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on Senate Bill Memorial 12? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on SJN 12. And we'll open a work session at SJN 12. Members, we've got the memorial in front of us. What's your pleasure?
I'll move SJN 12 to the floor of the due pass.
Representative Byer moves SJN 12 to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any further questions? Clerk, can we call the roll?
Representative Atkinson? And Beck? Representative
Byers?
Aye. Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Manning?
Aye.
Representative Piercy?
Excuse.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Welch?
Aye.
Representative
Williams?
Aye.
Representative
Smith? Aye. For the record, I show Atkinson as excused, please.
The measure having received the necessary votes is passed, and we'll have Representative Jensen carry the ball, carry the bill. But you said pass. So. So we'll close the work session on SJN 12.
SJN
12.
Okay, well, at this point we'll open the public hearing on SCR 2.
Mr. Chair and committee members, SCR 2, establishing a memorial for the life and service of Reverend Walter J. McGettigan to the citizens of Oregon. Reverend McGettigan died of natural causes on April 4, 1997, at the age of 89. Reverend McGettigan was a spiritual leader, social worker, and steward of his community. He served in the Governor's Commission on Aging and was instrumental in establishing the current senior services and disabled division.
And this is Rand.
Good afternoon. Are you still acting chair?
Yes.
All right. Representative Starr and members of the committee, I'm Phyllis Rand, representing the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, and I'm here to urge the committee for favorable consideration on SCR 2, memorializing the life and contributions of Reverend Walter McGettigan. He was a very special man, and I was fortunate to have time to get to know him. He spoke very softly, and he spoke softly because he knew that in order to hear, you had to really listen. And he had a wonderful sense of humor. the body of SCR 2 describes the life and contributions of this great man. Unfortunately, words just can't describe his ability to know what needed to happen for seniors and persons with disabilities. So included in your testimony are the ORSs, the policy section that describes the important pieces that he knew needed to be there in place when the division was formed. He went around the state to get support because no one really believed that you should, in fact, bring together things like Older Americans Act, Oregon Project Independence, and Medicaid long-term care programs all under the same umbrella. His idea was to emphasize those programs and to design them so that they would be delivered as a true partnership and with federal and local and city governments and state, along with private health and social service agencies and volunteer workers. In 1980, this was a pretty revolutionary idea. And so we have him to thank for that. He's gone, but he's left us a very special legacy in Oregon. And actually, Oregon is known all around the United States for the progressive ideas that we have for our Senior Disabled Services Division. It is our hope that SCR 2 will help keep his memory and his legacy very much alive. I want to thank you very much. If there are any questions, I'll answer them.
Thank you, Ms. Grand. Are there any questions from the committee?
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on SCR 2? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on SCR 2. We'll open a work session on SCR 2. Representative
Devlin? Yes. Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Consent Resolution 2 to the floor with the due process recommendation.
Representative Devlin, move SCR 2 to the floor with the due process recommendation. Any discussion or questions? Seeing none. Is there any objection? Seeing none, motion passes. And we'll carry the bill. Representative Devlin?
Okay.
Representative Devlin, carry the bill. Both work up in SCR 2. Representative Federley? You're here to speak on HCR 21?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll open the public hearing on HCR 21.
And I was going to say House Bill 2776, I think, is also on the agenda for today, but soon. I'll be very brief on HCR 21. For the record, Lane Shetterly, State Representative for District 34. We had a public hearing on this 2 or 3 weeks ago. This is the resolution that would amend the portion of the Constitution relating to the initiative process by reducing from 6% to 5% the signature requirements for the purpose of statutory amendments, statutory laws, and increasing from 8% to 12% the signature requirements for constitutional amendments. Again, I think you heard testimony, and I'd be happy just to be here to either answer questions or participate in your discussion at your pleasure.
Mr. Williams, do you wish to add anything?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad to see that my last name is still a problem with this committee. I am a member. Regardless of who's chairing, it's always a pleasure to be in this committee.
You're chairing the name?
And members.
No, you can see it over here.
I'll just echo the comments of my good friend, Representative Shetterly, and just say that I think we had a fairly good discussion about various options related to changes in these numbers and percentages when this bill was heard with a number of others that had similar proposals. I would say that I still stand firmly behind what HJR 21 attempts to accomplish, and I'll be happy to answer questions.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize, I missed that whole debate on this, but just a couple of details. We went to from 6 to 5 and 8 to 12. Do you know what numerically, based on, let's say, last election, what we would expect to qualify for this coming election, you know, the number of signatures that would be required?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edwards, in numbers provided to us by the Secretary of State in his testimony, I'll just read this paragraph for the record. HCR 21 changes the signature requirements for proposing statewide initiatives. It lowers the signature requirement for proposing statutory initiatives from 6% of those voting in the previous elections for governor to 5. That would take it from about 67,000 to 55,000 and raises the signature requirement for proposing constitutional initiatives from 8 to 12% or about 89,000 up to 134,000.
To follow on to that, do you, I mean, I guess my own personal feeling about this, and it's more of a statement, is in my experience in this building, is the difference between what becomes statutory and what becomes constitutional, as, and I assume one of the reasons we're doing this is one to protect the Constitution a little more, or at least make it a little more difficult to amend the Constitution, and I don't know if you've commented on how changing the signature to 12 would that, if that would have screened out some that you, a number of them, I don't know if you've got a comment or there was testimony on that, but to me, my experience in this building has been it doesn't matter whether it's constitutional or statutory, it's awfully hard to make a change. And I don't know if that's my own kind of personal view, and maybe that's not the thrust. Maybe the thrust is to try, and that's maybe the question is this, are you trying to give the Constitution a little more protection, and i.e., therefore, a better representation of the populace, hence the higher numbers to get a constitutional change.
Okay, to that, then, Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, as to the first question, no, I don't think there was any discussion about which of the recent initiatives might not have met the threshold. I think that's probably difficult to say because, of course, they were targeted to achieve a certain number of signatures, and it would be hard to say that they couldn't have gotten a higher number of signatures if a higher number had been required of them. So I don't think there's been any effort to try and establish that. And as to the other part, comment about it being difficult to amend the even the statutory, I guess my response to that would be it is and it isn't. It depends on what the nature of the change is. For instance, last session we had to re-refer Measure 17, if you recall, that's the constitutional prison work initiative, to make a very minor and very technical correction to conform it to federal law. We found ourselves out of compliance with federal, I forget which statute that was, that supersedes state enactments. And so that was a case where I'm just sure that a statutory change would have been easily made because it didn't affect the substance of the bill, didn't change the purpose of it, but it corrected a technical defect in it. In that case, it had to be re-referred and go through the whole process because it was a constitutional amendment. In this session, we are doing some, again, minor changes to the Death with Dignity Act. The Senate has worked on a bill that now is in possession of the House Judiciary Committee that has concurrence with the Right to Life, Right to Die, the Catholic hospitals, and everybody who needs to be on board with that. And because of the statutory amendment, we will be able to do that and do it easily without having to go through the drill of re-referral. Certainly, it is politically, there are always questions you have to look at very carefully before you wade into changing even statutory enactments. But I think that's a good example and a good illustration where when we're talking about non-substantive changes, we are greatly benefited by the ability to do that through a statutory initiative and in fact hampered by the inability to do that easily on a constitutional report. And then,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edwards, I guess my comments would echo those of Representative Shirley, but they give us a little bit of a different tack. I think with the small difference in between the two now, and when parties consider the amount of money that it will take to get an initiative on the ballot, it's really a very small thing to decide, let's just go for a constitutional amendment, because of the difference. And then you do, as Representative Shirley points out, to some degree, tie the hands of the legislature. Now, obviously, that's their right, and obviously some people do it specifically for that reason. But I think it's interesting that since 92, 28 of the 49 proposed initiatives have been, in fact, constitutional amendments. We are beginning to treat our Constitution, members of this committee, as you well know, like a super statute. I quite frankly think that's troubling. And it does, in fact, tie the hands of this body to make those corrections that will likely need to be made in any of these proposals without re-referral. And so the process breeds on itself. And I think, I don't know about you, but almost to the person I've talked to, although people are very supportive of the initiative process, the comments that I have generally heard is they want it to work better than it does. I think HJR 21 is a step in that direction in allowing this process to work better than it does in meeting the needs of more Oregonians.
Very follow up.
Yes, Mr. Beverly.
I mean, I agree with both of you about our role in this. I mean, I think that, I guess my personal feeling is it's been tough, and both parties have different views about what's good or bad policy. There tends to be, a tendency to hide behind an initiative because it was passed. I mean, you hear about this was passed years ago. It's still voter initiative. And both sides, both parties play that a lot. I mean, I go to your comment, Representative Williams, which is, I think our job is, if the policy needs to change, and that's we're elected, we should take that on, regardless of what part of who's in control. And that it's tough. I mean, you'll find, as a procession, but you'll find that's a tough one, regardless of what the issue is. And I think, the one question, I don't know if this was raised last time you were here, about raising the constitutional, because I agree that that's, to me, a policy concern about how much we're amending the Constitution. How do you respond to the critics would say, you're just making it more expensive to go to the Constitution. It's not necessarily going to prohibit or at least limit it. Because, again, in this day and age, it's a lot of paid signatures. It's typical how you get something on the ballot. And by raising the signatures, you're just raising the cost. And so the populist side would say, hey, that's you're prohibiting people to go to the Constitution, one. And secondly, you're also raising the cost, period. So how do you address that concern? I'm not taking a side. I'm just saying that would be a criticism of doing this, or maybe it was already echoed in the midst of this one.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edwards, I think you hit upon, obviously, probably the biggest criticism of HJR 21, is that it does, in fact, simply raise the cost and that people will just simply pay more money to get more paid signature gatherers out there to collect a higher number of signatures. I guess I hope that in this process of debate and deliberation, as this proposal rolls out to the people, like we are having a deliberative, thoughtful analysis of what the initiative process means in Oregon and what the Oregon Constitution means in the context of government in this state, that it will heighten this issue for people. That people will begin to consider the issue when they go to sign a petition. Is this a constitutional change, or is this merely a statutory change? Part of that's going to be through education. I think part of it will be from understanding what HJR 21 proposes to accomplish. I guess I have a greater faith, despite the fact that people argue that this looks like we don't have faith in the voters of Oregon. Frankly, I have a greater faith that as we continue to emphasize why there is a difference, there should be a difference between a statutory and constitutional amendment, people will begin to respond to that.
Mr. Chair, if I may respond too, I think in the Revenue Committee we are reminded time and time again that economics drives market responses, and I think there's a behavioral side of this that to the extent that the effect of this is in fact to raise the cost of getting constitutional initiatives on the ballot, I think the market response, so to speak, in the market of the initiative market, may very well be to veer away from the tendency to favor constitutional amendments over statutory, which in fact I think is not very subtly one of the purposes of the bill. Yet, as you say, you know, it's not going to be an absolute prohibition. So in those cases where it is appropriate and called for constitutional change to be made, it's still going to be doable. It's subtle, and it's always hard to model these things dynamically, but my expectation is that we would see that. Of course, the other side is that the legislature remains an alternative way to get constitutional amendments on the ballot, and for that you only need still 31 and 16 votes. So that is clearly an alternative to the initiative process that would still be available to people who want to work through the legislative process to get initiatives out on constitutional reform. And frankly, I think that's a good way to encourage them to go too.
I will support this, although my fear and my thinking is that this isn't going to get to what I think we all want, which is, in my opinion, which I think what I'm hearing you say, which is to try to make it a little more difficult to get to the Constitution. There are other ways to do it. This may help, but my sense is, as we see voter turnout going down, and maybe vote by mail picking up, I don't know, but the trend is down, so you know, we've bumped it up, but it's still, it's based on participation, and I hope you're right. I hope this will help, but I don't know. I'm a little skeptical.
This is Devin.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Williams and Representative Sellers. Going along the same lines, isn't your hope also that, now if you look at it currently and we're only at 6 and 8, obviously there's not much of an economic incentive there to go statutory versus constitutional. They're relatively close. Is that not only will you maybe impact the people filing petitions, the people signing petitions, but ultimately because constitutional measures will be more rare on the ballot versus statutory, we may have just as many initiatives, if not more.
Yeah.
But we'll have constitutional ones will be rarer. The public will take a recognition of something that's constitutional versus statutory, which they don't currently.
I think that's a good point.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, I would say that that's exactly kind of the point that I made, taking considerably more time than needed to make it.
I'll be into the once in a while. And Mr. Chair, if I can respond to that, I think it's a good point that this is not an anti-initiative resolution. This bill leaves open the door to every bit as many resolutions as we're currently seeing. I see this as being more in the sense of protecting the historical integrity of our Constitution, which was, after all, designed to be the fundamental document that defines the relationship of the government to the people and the organizational structure of government, and it's become overloaded with I think as Representative Williams said, elements that are basically statutory in nature, and with that we're losing the fundamental nature of our Constitution. So this is not an anti-initiative effort at all. I think I see it as more an effort to try to protect the Constitution and preserve it as the nature of the instrument in which it was supposed to be.
Thank you very much. I'm going to recess the public hearing on HR 21.
Don't bother me at all.
And Mr. Shadow, you wanted to offer some comments on House Bill 2776 earlier. And then I'd like to let you have your comments and then bring Senator Lim up for the SJR statement we've got and then proceed with the hearing on both of them. I open public hearing on House Bill 2776.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your indulgence and accommodations. Again, for the record, Lane Shatterly, State Representative, District 34. House Bill 2776 touches on the initiative process as well by providing a role for legislative counsel in reviewing prospective petitions for state measures by initiative. It provides for a stopover in the legislative counsel office, that is, through the legislative counsel committee, to to provide legislative counsel an opportunity to confer, to review and confer or attempt to confer, it says, with the chief petitioners of the measure. This is, there's nothing coercive in this statute. It does not require the chief petitioners to in fact confer. And if there is conference between the chief petitioners and legislative counsel, there's nothing in the bill that requires the chief petitioners to take to heart the advice of legislative counsel or amend the petition. What it does, I think, is provide an opportunity for petitioners of initiative measures to avail themselves of the expertise of legislative counsel as we do in drafting our bills. And thereby, I hope, and this is my hope in sponsoring this bill, avoid the pitfalls we have seen of measures that once they have qualified for the ballot, become known to have defects, but still go forward in the election because they have achieved the signature requirements, putting us in a position then in the legislature of having to correct deficiencies that could have been corrected if they had been exposed. I think this will lead to higher quality initiatives, or at least the opportunity for higher quality initiatives, through this process that intentionally brings legislative counsel in for the consultation process. Again, I want to emphasize this is not coercive. It doesn't require the chief petitioners to confer. It simply creates a means by which legislative counsel can be part of the process, I think more overtly than is presently the case, and through that have the opportunity to correct, in most cases, I think what would amount to technical problems with the bill that is going through the initiative process.
Thank you very much, Mr. Severly. And Mr. Williams, you're also on the bill, but if I may, I'd like to recess the public hearing on House 5776 and come back to it just momentarily.
Thank you.
Questions for Representative Severly before you leave? Thank you very much.
Thank you for your courtesy. Appreciate it.
I will recess the public hearing on House 5776 and open a public hearing on Senate Black Memorial 10 and Senator Lim. Yes, Mr.
Moore, please give us an overview. Mr. Chairman, members, Senate Joint Memorial 10 urges the United States Congress and President to use appropriate means to resolve the issue of American soldiers and pilots still missing from the Korean War.
May I talk to you then?
Thank you, Chair Simmons and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Lim, State Senator from District 11. It will be 50 years anniversary that the 2000, June 25, since the broke out of the Korean War 1950, June 25. This Korean War known as a forgotten war, but I don't believe it is forgotten to the mind of the parents and children, uncles and relatives, to those who are missing the 8,177 known members still missing during the Korean War. They are not accounted for. We don't know where they are. They are died or someplace in other parts of the world. We do not know anything about it. And we need to resolve this matter. This is a very serious matter. I was in North Korea last year, June, invited by the North Korean government. I tried to discuss some of the issues of this MIA issue during the Korean War. Since we have 57 young men and women and are missing from our state alone, at least I tried to find out some information where they are. Since I'm a state senator from this state, they couldn't find any one of them. I think it is the responsibility of the American people and the Congress and the President to resolve this matter as soon as possible. I think the time is approaching. Since 1953, Korean War ended, it is ended with a truce. It is not ended of the war. Technically, North and South Korea at war without fighting at this time. The war could break out sometime in the future, but we hope not. Because of the concern we have of American citizens and on behalf of their relatives in our state, I introduce the SJF 10 urging Congress and the President to dissolve this 8,177, and I urge the members of this committee to pass this bill as soon as possible so that we can send a message to the Congress and to the President of the United States.
Thank you very much, Senator Lim, for coming today. Any questions of the committee for Senator Lim?
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it.
We have John Mangus and Ed Hughes. Would you gentlemen mind coming up together? Would you identify yourself for the record and proceed?
Chair, members of the committee for the record, my name is John Mangus. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And I just wanted to come here today to urge your support and passage of SJM 10 for a lot of reasons. One, in Vietnam, we spent 10 years and 58,000 Americans were killed. In Korea, we spent 3 years and 54,000 Americans were killed. It was a terrible, violent war. 8,177 Americans are still not accounted for. And the senator mentioned 57 from Oregon. And just one little story to kind of bring it up to date, because this is 50 years ago, and time tends to distort and make us forget about the importance of things. But in 1953, Lieutenant Robert Nyman was engaged in aerial combat against the MiG near the South-North Korean border and was shot down. His body was not recovered. The aircraft wreckage was not spotted. He was presumed killed in action. His daughter, a Mrs. Ann Backinson from Portland, grew up believing that her father had been killed in the service. And then one day in 1992, she was reading the Oregonian at the breakfast table, and she read an article on the Korean War, where the Russian colonel had announced that Robert Nyman was one of the American pilots that was brought into Russia for interrogation back in 1953. Well, since that time, there's been no word on how, you know, or where Lieutenant Nyman is, or is he alive or is he deceased. But it's still an open question, and I think the memorial itself to Congress is an important incentive just to encourage the government to keep up that search for Oregonians and Americans who are still considered missing in action. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I think I really do urge your support this morning.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Simmons, committee members, for the record, my name is Ed Hughes, Oregon veteran, and we second the comments of Mr. Mangus.
Can you let the audience wish to discuss by SJM 10? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on SJM 10 and open the work session on SJM 10.
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Walsh.
I move Senate Joint Memorial 10 to oppose the detailed recommendation.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Is there any discussion? Yes, for Senator Mannix.
I strongly support the memorial. I hope, too, that perhaps we'll be getting the word out, too, to the membership that May 15, I believe, will be unveiling the Memorial to Oregon Volunteers. I think that's the date it's failing.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hope that when this comes up for debate, perhaps that would be an appropriate time to mention that there is a permanent memorial being erected here in Salem. But this is a parenthetical remark. Thank you, Mr. Chamberlain.
Further discussion? We have a motion before us. I can move the bill to the floor with the memorial for the due pass recommendations. Any objection? Hearing none, so moved. And we will close the public work session on SJM 10. And
any further?
I'm carrying.
Okay. Representative Wilson is carrier. And we will now reopen the public hearing on HCR 21.
I'm Ray Phelps, representing AFSCME, Organs to Maintain and IBEW, and I'm here just to restate our support for HCR 21, and I have nothing more to add to what Representative Shirley Williams shared with the committee.
Thank you.
Chair?
Yes, Representative Getbeck.
Has the Senate passed a similar measure this session?
Not to my knowledge. Next we have Kathy Eaton.
Chair Simmons, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kathy Eaton, government chair for the League of Women Voters. I simply would also reiterate the comments about the Constitution being the basic framework of the state that were given by Representative Shutterly and Representative Williams, and urge you to send this to the floor. Chair Simmons, you ask about the Senate. They had a bill extremely similar to this, SJR-4, which did not come out of committee.
Okay. I thought that was actually what they had to move out yet.
No, thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Eaton? Thank you. Okay, close the public hearing. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on HCR 21? We'll close the public hearing on HCR 21 and open the work session on HCR 21.
I urge the committee to send us to the floor with a DPAS recommendation.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion to send HCR 21 to the floor with a DPAS recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Chair, is that a urge or
move.
It was a movement,
yes it was.
Okay, yes, Representative Mannix.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we've talked about this a lot. I think it's pretty complex what we're doing here, but I wanted to say that this is seen and is meant to be a compromise designed to make it a tougher to put an amendment to the Constitution in a state that encourage folks to look through initiatives that would change statute. And I think it's an equitable compromise. The reason I'm making these remarks is that some of us are going to get beaten up for supporting this, for being anti-initiative. Well, I'm the greatest, I'm second to none in this assembly in supporting the initiative process. But I also recognize that we need balance. And this seems to be a good, cautious approach to giving us some balance in the initiative process without undermining the people's right to be heard and requiring a little extra effort if you want that very hard to change constitutional provision and allowing a little less effort for that not so hard to change statutory. Well, we all know how hard it is to change some statutes. that is not as hard as a constitutional change. So I think it's a fair balance and I appreciate the proponents coming forward with it and I'll support it.
Thank you very much. Further discussion? Commissioner Welch?
I just want to render my support, certainly, too, but I feel the same as Representative Mannix does here, is that certainly I view this to begin with as a constitutional law protection measure, and I certainly still do. It's not one that that I viewed as initiative affront in any way, and I just hope that the others will support this and realize that we can, I think, defend our vote in this process because there's nothing more, to me, more important than the Constitution.
Representative Beck?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I share some of Representative Edwards'
concerns that he indicated earlier about this simply just making it more expensive to get to do constitutional initiatives. Although I guess I have my greater concern involves the fact that we have a constitution that needs some changes, and that we maybe make it more difficult to make some needed changes to the constitution. That's the main reason I oppose the efforts to have the Representative Edwards other bill 3/5 majority requirement for approval of constitutional amendments of initiatives. I do think the citizens who are wise enough to recognize the inadequacies or inequities of our state's constitution should be able to move forward and make some necessary changes. And this might heighten that bar a little, well, obviously we'll raise that bar a little higher, but I think overall it's better than establishing supermajorities for actual approval of these measures. So I'm going to support it with a little bit of reluctance, but overall this is the sort of thing we should be putting on the ballot this session.
Thank you, Representative Beck. Further comments from the committee?
Just one thing, Mr. Chair, and I want to just reiterate sort of my support for this also. I think this is, we got to make the first step. I think this is the first step. That's how I do this. I think this has been long overdue. The Constitution, as was described earlier in Representative Beck, we tend to be going that route more, and I think if this can help, I'm hopeful that our intent is right, that this will make the bar high enough that people will look more towards statutory, where a lot of, I think, law could go. And again, I see this as a first step. While I may disagree with my colleague from Portland about whether we should raise the bar totally for how we get a constitutional measure passed, I think that could be another debate. But we need to start somewhere, and this is a good start.
Thank you very much.
Hey, Mr. Chair. If we had one here, just to ask for objections or go through a roll call process, that I will object. I do like Representative Edwards' idea of raising the bar for the vote, but I don't want to go the other direction and lower the bar for the statute.
And just for the record, if the voters do approve HCR 21, they could potentially avoid train wrecks that we had last session. I can believe refer out to people Measure 50 and the problems that we had with our property tax measure 47 that last session.
Not to interrupt this.
And if that had been a statutory measure, we wouldn't have had to go back to voters again to fix the problem and make it more workable.
The logic, I didn't quite follow it, but I'll...
But I
sure he explained it to me. He explained it to me.
He could have been statutory, we wouldn't have had to go back to the resolution.
He cleared me up, I got it.
You just didn't understand the Republican thinking.
Well, sometimes I didn't say, you're from Portland, so... No offense intended.
Representative Fire. Representative Williams.
Aye.
Representative
Tonight. Aye. And HR 21 is moved before the due pass recommendation. Representative Williams, that carries the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Close of the work session on HR 21. And Representative Devlin has asked that we hold 2776 discussion on that just momentarily while he goes and testifies on another bill. Mr. Chamoff, which one are you here for? 2776. Well, I do apologize. He's gone to testify, so he would be back momentarily.
May we inquire of Mr. Chamoff anyway while Representative Devlin's out of the room? Or? up to you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to...
That's my plan. I mean, why don't you come on up and we will open, reopen the recess public hearing on House Bill 2776.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Greg Chamot, Legislative Council. I'm not here to take a position on the bill, but simply to be available to answer any questions you may have about how it might affect the operations of the office.
Thank you very much. Would you like to elaborate on how it might affect the operations of your office?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we anticipate that most of the initiated measures that come to our office will require, at least in our view, a substantial reworking to fit nicely with the current statutory or constitutional schemes, and that this measure would require substantial additional resources, including during the time that you are in session. And
just a minute. Just close the door. Thank you.
Provided the body provides additional resources so that we can meet this obligation, we can do that without interrupting the services that we would otherwise be providing to members in the committee.
So fiscal. And we have 15 minutes. We'll state the other issues.
Yes, President Williams.
Tim, have you been asked to prepare a fiscal analysis to weigh in on the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, yes.
And you have is it here?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not going to have it. Okay, in today's packet, all right.
We did pass out another bill that would require individuals in order to access this service to have collected 1% of the necessary signatures. And we that went across the floor of the House just earlier this week, but then Devlin carried it. Which raises the bar somewhat. People wouldn't be coming in every week or every other day with a new proposal. It would monopolize some of your time in legislative council. We are sensitive to that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we understand that this bill addresses a different issue, which is completed petitions by a member of the public have to be filed with our office for review, as opposed to someone coming in at the front end saying, hi, I'd like help with the drafting.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Mack.
I think I need to disagree with that interpretation. I see this as being assistance being offered when a prospective petition is filed, looking for authorization of the circulation of the petition.
I believe that's correct.
Oh, I see the issue. Your concern, Mr. Chairman, I want to make sure that we're on the time frame here. You've got the prospective petition. That's filed with the Secretary of State. Then there's authorization for circulation of the petition using the final measure summary in lieu of the ballot title. Is this coming up before you go out and get your 1%, or is this coming up after, under the new legislation, you've gotten 1% of the signatures for the criteria? That's what I'm trying to put in terms of the time frame.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, if I understand correctly, the 1% requirement is what would be necessary to come ask our office for drafting services. This bill requires every prospective measure to be filed with our office, regardless of how many signatures someone is required, and then we review it. We review the prospective measure and report back to the petitioner.
there are two different ways of obtaining the same services.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Just in a minute.
On the other measure where we said you had to have 1% of the, now it should be 5% possibly or 12%, your trigger level of signatures, that other already provides for some conferring or not?
And Mr. Chair, Representative Simmons, if what I understand has happened is that you have amended the statute that previously required us to provide drafting services upon the submission of a certain number of signatures, then that threshold would have gone up. Once someone's done that, we've prepared the petition for them, and they file it. We don't have to reconfer with them because we've already done it. But the vast majority of petitions are not prepared through our office, so we anticipate that virtually all of the petitions will be reviewed using the process under House Bill 2776 rather than the 1%. And I don't mean to be suggesting that we're not willing to undertake this obligation. We probably more than most folks are sensitive to the damage that a poorly written statute or constitutional provision can do to the original document. We just want to make sure that the body understands that this is a substantial additional obligation that will require additional resources so that we don't end up interrupting the services that we provide to this body.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chima, currently, if a member requests, you would work with a petitioner, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, absolutely. That is, in fact, the most common way that we end up working with a petitioner.
President Green,
thank you. Just to follow up to Representative Starr's question, Mr. Chima, how often are you doing that annually now? Do you have an idea?
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, twice.
Okay. So, under the analysis here, you believe that if we pass 2776, you believe that we would go up to 150 or so, is what you're anticipating in the plan. Am I right about that?
And Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, yes.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm listed as one of the chief co-sponsors of 2776, and I still believe it's a good idea. I think that one of the most significant challenges that we have in the initiative system is, frankly, the kind of stuff you just referenced in the last bill, which is the drafting problems that arise in complicated measures. I think as between the two bills, when it comes to the issue of solving problems, I think the potential for 2776 to solve problems is probably higher. Because hopefully we get it right the first time and we don't have to take it up today. There's even a statutory pick with the legislative pick. Frankly, I think $172,000 is probably, considering the amount of court time, legal expenses from various branches of government, and legislative consultation, it's a small price to pay for some better drafted measures. And so I would still support it, recognizing that it's one of many other things that aren't recommended in the governor's budget and probably aren't on the it's not on the radar screen of the co-chairs in ways of me. So I guess I'm going to be I want to continue to support the proposal. I think legislative council's office is the right place for this work to be done because the initiative is essentially an extension of the legislative branch of government in this state and the legislative function. But I recognize the challenge that this faces from a fiscal impact standpoint. I guess be interested in the thoughts of other members of the committee on how hard we want to push this to ensure that it gets some funding. Because the last thing I want to do is put legislative council in a position to where they can't adequately do this job or the job they currently do for us. And I say that as a new member on the legislative council committee as well.
Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question that I would throw out is,
how much of this work would be done during a legislative session when legislative council is already stressed to the max with members asking for amendments and legislation? I don't know the answer to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, if my recollection is correct, the Secretary of State's office has received so far during this session somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 or 50 prospective petitions. So under this bill, we would have reviewed those, and then if the proponents requested it, provided services to them.
Is there a timeline in this bill? A certain amount of time?
We have 20, Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, we have 20 days to get back to the proponent with our comments, and then there are 5 days after that for the proponent to submit essentially a corrected petition that presumably we would have fixed for them.
Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that one of the things that can be done to referring to fiscal impact is to note that this isn't going to go on the ballot until November in the year 2000, and it won't start affecting petitions until the ones for the next cycle. Of course, that isn't the next session, it's an assembly. I'm sensitive to the concern about conferring with chief petitioners and providing them with assistance. I think that that may be one way to avoid scrambled petitions. But I do think we need to be aware of the fiscal impact, and with a kind of a fiscal impact statement, perhaps, I'm not pressing this, but I'm raising the question, Ways and Means could take a look at that and make a determination if it's something that needs to be budgeted for. I am concerned about a workload that cannot be absorbed as far as I'm concerned during session. I don't think the workload during session is, on these petitions will be as strong as the workload after session. So during session, we are already operating way over 100% capacity as far as I'm concerned with legislative by council. So I want another, what I'm saying is I couldn't support this unless we sent this to Ways and Means to make sure that they budget it. But I think we have to send it to Ways and Means anyway, and if we decide it's a good policy choice, get it to make that determination and provide the appropriate staffing to do the job.
I kind of like to follow along that line. I think maybe another way to handle it would be to not necessarily take action today and have a further discussion about the ability to get this financed, because I think the policy sound is, do we have the money to do it? And I'm not sure we've seen any indication that this is the case, and send it down the way it means it may or may not come back. So I guess, and they'd be willing to do what the committee wanted to, but it seems like maybe we could get a little better indication about how this might fare down there.
It appears to me that the fiscal may need to be amended. It has $172,000 for 9901 year. Maybe that's, does that account for only the last 6 months of this biennium?
Mr. Chair, no. That would be the entire biennium.
Entire biennium. Williams?
Mr. Chairman, I'm certainly willing to do whatever the pleasure of the chair is with respect to the bill. The chair is not enamored with the idea of just passing the bill out to Ways and Means. I would be willing to work with Representative Shetterly to have some discussions with the folks on the Ways and Means Committee and also with Mr. Kamoff to see what we can do. I guess I'd rather, from my own personal standpoint, I'd rather keep a little bit more control of the bill if the chairman is amenable to that, than to have it sent down the phone yard where it's a little bit difficult to keep an eye on.
That's some significantly more difficult to put into the black hole. Was it in that?
Well, the fiscal may also be amended once it's determined that this doesn't have impact until the next cycle. But there is a problem there in that the next initiative cycle doesn't start until, I mean, it does not wait until January of 2001. It starts when this initiative cycle ends, which is about July 2000. So we are talking half of this biennium where people are already conferring. And this fiscal impact, I don't think there's any way to avoid it being over $50,000, no matter how you cut it. And at that point, it seems to me it doesn't have to be the boneyard. It depends on whether or not we've got
to have the right kind of zest for life for the bill.
Right. Well, I do think this is a good idea. We'd like to see it go forward in some form. Mr. Devlin?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. I agree with Representative Williams in that I would hope that we would hold on to this as long as we can or need to make it as clean a bill as possible so that when it goes on to Ways and Means, should it have to go on to Ways and Means, that what you're seeking is a hearing and a work session, not seeking approval of multiple amendments to the bill. So that would be my preference. For the record, I wanted to point out one other issue that I discussed with both you and Representative Williams, and that is in the dash one amendments that talks about the estimates or the impact of the measure. I have received a communication, oral communication from the Secretary of State's office, that they have a concern that the way that would be set up now, that you're starting it so that that estimate would have to be done at the beginning of the process. The people that I believe are involved in that estimate is the Secretary of State, the Treasurer, the head of DAS, and the Director of the Department of Revenue. If they had to do that for every initiative that came up in the beginning, the impact would be significant. Their recommendation would be that we could amend this so that we could do a preliminary estimate, which is what would appear on the petition set by legislative fiscal. And then ultimately, should the ballot measure qualify and should there be a voter's sample statement, a final fiscal impact would be done by the parties that I previously indicated. And that amendment, that's my limited understanding of their communication to me.
Is
there
a minute?
I'm sorry, but I don't see where the estimated fiscal impact on that has to be put together is in this bill.
Yes. It's in the dash one amendment.
Oh.
The dash one amendment is the essence of House Bill 2674 that required that the estimated fiscal impact be printed on the signature sheet. And had that brought out separately for the consideration of the committee.
Mr. Chairman?
Within a minute.
I've always thought that the estimated fiscal impact was the weakest part of this decision. Anything that adds juice to that or puts it on petitions is absolutely objectionable. So if you want to put an anchor around the neck of this bill, that'll do it. And I'll tell you why. To me, it's like art and beauty. It's in the eye of the beholder. And I think the fiscal impact estimates are junk, largely speaking. Unless it's a very narrow initiative that has a very limited fiscal impact. And I just remember the $1 billion in prison construction that we were going to have to do that people still talk about that now is down to $600 million. And, gee, they're only 40% off. It was great. Great campaign fodder. So I've got a real problem with fiscal impact, and I'd have a real problem with this bill. I think we got to stay away from that if we want to move on this other issue, which is a very legitimate issue about having some legal analysis of the language of the initiative.
Mr. Chairman, just for the record, and so Representative Manis doesn't hit me when we walk out of the room, I did not offer nor ask for the dash one amendment. I frankly don't know whose they are. And so, with that stated, I feel safer walking back to my office.
Mr. Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, at the discretion of the chair, I will have amendments prepared to basically make this correction the Secretary is seeking in the dash one amendment. But I can tell you quite honestly, if the dash one amendments are not passed by this committee and put in part of the bill, I think the Secretary of State's concern that the bill goes away.
Okay, further discussion.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Sounds like we can work well and send it without the dash one amendments, the Ways and Means of the due tax.
We might be in that position this afternoon even.
Mr. Chairman, I would rather keep control of the bill here to work and let me work out the issue with Ways and Means if we can do that if the chair doesn't feel the need to move the bill today.
Well, we don't have to do it today, but it's certainly an option. We do have some people kind of set on this bill. We have Ray Phelps. And you can represent the Dash 1 amendment also if you care to.
Yeah. My name is Ray Phelps, representing AFSCME, Organizers for Maintaining Community Standards, and IBEW Local 48. With respect to House Bill 2776, I think I'll maybe take the long walk on the short plank.
But you passed out the 1% and they passed the House. That 1% applies to 2776 because of the term prospective petition. The objective of 1% was to diminish the number of ballot title choppings that go on. So I suspect in the number that you've received, I don't suspect it, I know it, in the number of petitions that have been filed, there are several filed by the same person for the same subject. So I think in your analysis of that, you ought to consider that these prospectives that we're talking about reflect the 1%. And applying that to the number of initiatives in the Secretary of State's office, you probably have some number less than, I think it was 40. I wasn't listening that closely. It was whatever number Mr. Chamberlain said. And because when you go through the bill, it's clear that the legislative council process with members is not what we're talking about. That's been out there for a long time. This will be the one where after 1% of the signatures have been obtained and the prospective petition is presented to the Secretary of State, that is what is anticipated in this legislation to be reviewed. And because as you look through the timelines, it's 10 days for this, 5 for that, 5 for that, connecting to the ballot title issued by the Attorney General and prior to the time the Supreme Court might or might not have to pass on that ballot title. So I think, you know, that might be helpful as you're making this analysis. With respect to House Bill 20, or the -1 amendments, frankly, this financial impact statement has to be made anyway. Does it have to be made for every prospective petition? No, because a lot of them are not certified. But I think what's occurring here and what I think this attempts to address is the fiscal or revenue limitations the state has. And whether the estimate is, you know, perfect or precise, I think is not insignificant. But I think it's important for Oregonians to know that, well, just fine, we'll put it on the ballot and we'll talk about it later. I think Oregonians need to know that you're going to have a fiscal impact, and if somebody were to ask me to sign, and I said, well, where are you going to get that money? And they're going to say, well, out of the budget. What budget? I think some information needs to be put forth that tells Oregonians that they are spending money when they sign these, not just getting it on the ballot, but has the real potential of spending money that may have to come from someplace else. If it didn't, I don't think we'd have near the difficulty we're having today in this particular session. So, we like the -1 amendments because I think they're informative. And the estimating process may be improved. That's our, that's in the eye of the beholder. But I think our Oregonians need to know that it's going to cost money and where's that money going to come from. So we're in support of both the bill and the -1 amendment.
Has anyone considered the constitutional issue since the United States Supreme Court has already ruled that you cannot make petition circulators carry badges of dishonor? The additional factor that you're suddenly going to require that a government-established fiscal impact has to be put on your petition that you're going to circulate among voters, don't you think that raises a question as to whether the U.S. Supreme Court, applying the more generous, easy free speech standards as opposed to the more rigorous free expression standards of the Oregon Supreme Court, wouldn't rule that that's an unconstitutional restraint on speech?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, I'm way out of my element when you ask me that question because I don't have the professional background to give you a competent answer, but it's my belief the answer would be no. I don't believe that you're diminishing in any way the circulator or in any way their opportunity of free speech. I think you're balancing the free speech conversation by making a total statement as the impact of that petition.
Chairman. Would the next step be that I would have to also carry a statement in opposition by the people who don't like the petition so that everybody will know what all the issues are?
Well, I guess that's how the voter pamphlet got to
work. Chairman, I have a representative to ask to talk forward so I can write these ideas down.
I'm sure it'll be available on the record for later if you care. You're happy to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Phelps.
You're welcome.
Kathy Eaton.
Pearson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kathy Eaton, Government Chair of League of Women Voters of Oregon, and we're here in support of House Bill 2776. When we did a fairly comprehensive study of the initiative process in Oregon 2 years ago, our members were convinced in talking with the public and in our discussions that some kind of review is necessary for the initiatives before they come to people to vote on them. I'm not going to belabor that point because it's already been made to you, but it is important that when we have an opportunity to do direct democracy, it would be helpful if we have the best possible petition initiatives to be voted upon, rather than having to go to the courts and the litigation costs that result from improperly written petitions, as important as the subject matter might be. So we are in support of a review process. While we did not specify in our position who should do that review, it makes sense that the Legislative Council be that body. There's already in statute the ability, as we understand it, for a petitioner to come to the Legislative Council and ask for a review. And if they do so, they need to pay for it. That's part of the reason we understand that more petitioners do not seek that advice. However, I'm not going to go into the fiscal impact segment of this, although we recognize that in support of this legislative review, it's necessary for the cost to be protected and covered for the review that Legislative Council would do. You asked a question earlier about how many petitions have been filed since the legislative session began. Those of us who collect all of these petitions, there were about 35 filed before the session started, and there are about 50 now, so there's been about 15 that have come in since the legislature started. That is, my file had 35 in it before we started deliberation. I don't know. I understood that only about two of those had had a request, that request, a request for only two that you've reviewed. None of those, but two on an average. Yeah, thank you. And it would now become mandatory for all those petitions to be reviewed. And I think it certainly makes good sense that you look at the fiscal impact of that. But we really do urge you to become involved with having some kind of legislative review with regard to initiative petitions, because direct democracy is being decimated by poor initiatives, by poor results, and we feel very strongly that this committee needs to consider having some kind of legislative review and being supportive of the cost that incurred.
Thank you very much. Is there any questions from the speaker? Thank you for coming today. There's one more person signed up, Mr. Meek.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dan Meek. I represent here the Coalition for Initiative Rights. On House Bill 2776, we testified on April 1st in opposition to the bill because it adds 25 days to the process for submitting a prospective petition. Now, under the -1 amendments, the bill would be very much more objectionable than it was then. What the -1 amendments would do would require the preparation of a fiscal impact statement by the four state officers and have that statement essentially attached to every signature sheet. One major problem with this is that there is no judicial review of the substance of the financial impact statement. The substance can be totally wrong, and this bill provides for no judicial review. So we have the statements of the four state officers, and there's nothing that any person or any citizen can do to correct the statement, no matter how outrageously false it might happen to be, or regardless of the misunderstandings of the state officials in dealing with it. That raises in a very serious way the question that was introduced by Representative Mannix about forced speech at the point of contact with voters. There is absolutely nothing on signature sheets or in petitions that are circulated now that constitutes forced speech without judicial review. Already now, we get the ballot title that is first of all prepared by the Attorney General, but then goes to the Oregon Supreme Court for a substantive review before the ballot title goes on the petition that is then printed on the back of the signature sheets or with the signature sheets for prospective signers to see and read. What this bill would do, however, the Dash 1 amendments, would be to place also on the signature sheet itself, which is far more intrusive than where the ballot title goes now, which is either on the back or in a separate document, but on the signature sheet itself, print a statement from government officials for which there is no judicial review of substance whatsoever. There's only judicial review for procedure. The only question to the court, according to the Dash 1 amendments, of course, is did the state officials issue their financial impact statement within the period of time that is provided for it? That's it. No review of substance.
I don't. My sense of the committee is that the Dash 1 amendments don't have legs.
Well, I've heard testimony so far by two witnesses in favor of it. No one else is opposing it. And
it has no legs. It has no legs.
I'm almost done. The other problem with it is the potential for additional delay in the opportunity to begin collecting signatures due to the fact that there is no deadline for the Supreme Court to issue any decision on anything that may be taken to it under this arrangement. You can only take to the Supreme Court the question of whether the procedures were met. Even so, the Supreme Court does not have to issue a decision within any specified period of time. On ballot title reviews, some of those take several months and essentially can destroy the opportunity to collect signatures on a petition because the signature collection season evaporates while review is being undertaken. It shouldn't be as serious a problem with procedural review, but since there is no deadline, the Supreme Court can take as much time as it wishes to do this. Third, recent invalidations of measures that were enacted by voters initiatives had nothing to do, basically, with how those measures were written. I'd like to correct that misapprehension. For example, Measure 40 was invalidated in the Armada decision under a doctrine that no one even knew about at the time Measure 40 was drafted. The One Amendment rule of Article 17 of the Constitution imported by the Supreme Court into Article 4 of the Constitution.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Nothing new for the Supreme Court to discern new doctrines that we never knew existed. So I can't say I'm totally surprised.
I agree.
Thank you.
So that has been offered as an indication of why this bill is necessary, that you need better drafting. My proposition is that even if the Legislative Council drafted Measure 40 completely, it would still have been invalidated because the Armada decision announced a new doctrine that the Legislative Council didn't know about any more than the drafters of Measure 40 knew about. And finally, since basically it seems that the mischief that this bill is aimed at, really, in providing the financial impact statement on signature sheets, are measures that substantially affect the finances of the state, perhaps it should be limited only to bills that change taxation and not initiatives that change taxation and not initiatives on every other subject, which is what this bill would do, which the Dash Amendments would do. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Meek?
Okay, Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Meek, let's assume for the moment, for purposes of argument, that the sheriff's disarmament is accurate and the Dash 1 amendments are legless, ergo will not proceed, but that we would have the basic bill. What if in the basic bill we also included the provision that allowed someone to circulate the petition with the certified ballot title, even though that may be under challenge to the Supreme Court? You talked about that before, Mr. Chairman. The idea being that we trade off the loss of time with consultation with legislative counsel with a gain of time, because let's face it, anytime something's contentious, the opponents are going to take it to court and allay it through the court proceedings.
by saying that once you have a certified ballot time, you may circulate petitions pending some decision by the Supreme Court. Once the Supreme Court petition comes down, if they've changed the ballot title, then that say within 30 days you have to start issuing fresh sheets. The idea being that what you've lost in time in consultation with legislative counsel, you more than make up for with being able to get the petition out on the street. I would add that that would not be a very inconsistent idea with the rest of this legislation, since we already have 1% of the signatures coming in without a ballot title, and then you could have some others being gained while they're with a certified ballot title, but without necessarily the final one. Of course, the ballot title supposedly is supposed to be on the ballot. That's what it's supposed to be all about. We somehow have decided it's a petition title. I'm giving you a long, argumentative, positive question to see if that would sort of balance things out a little bit in this bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, yes, I believe it would. That's something that the Coalition for Initiative Rights would support. That is, allowing the circulation of petitions with the ballot title that was prepared by the Attorney General, the final ballot title prepared by the Attorney General, even though a challenge to the Supreme Court may be pending.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Meek? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2776 and go on down to House Bill 3053, open the public hearing.
Thank you.
I'll ask staff to give us an overview of House Bill 3053, and then you might have some comments.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, House Bill 3053 requires fiscal effect on the signatures on state initiative of a referendum petition submitted, modifies requirements for contribution to Tennessee report called by candidates and political action committees. Included with this package is the Dash 1 amendment, which replaced Section 1 of the bill as written with the language directed to Secretary of State to adopt the fiscal estimate procedure. It restores the address requirement and leaves as written the deletion of occupational requirements.
If I may, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. The Dash 1 amendment, then, first of all, contains compromised language worked out with the Secretary of State in regard to the statistical estimated signature duplication rate. I met with Colleen Seelock, and she and her folks came up with this compromised language. The second part of the Dash 1 amendment is meant to be a backing away from the original bill in the respect of the listing of the address for the contributors. To put back in the requirement that the address of the contributors should be listed on the report, but to leave out the requirement that you list the occupation, and to leave out the requirement still that you have to keep a track of the aggregate contributions made by some individuals. If you simply report how much was contributed and who contributed it and what their address is, but you don't have to try to keep track of the cumulative totals for anybody, and you also don't have to report the occupation. That's where we are with the Dash 1 amendment.
Thank you very much, Mr. Manick and Mr. Bell.
Good evening, Mr. Chair. I'm Ray Phelps, representing AFSCME, Oregon Used to Maintain Community Standards, and IBEW Local 48. I had not seen the Dash 1 amendments until this evening, and reading the Dash 1 amendments, we are going to withdraw our support for this measure, House Bill 3053, because it accomplishes nothing that would achieve the purposes for which we embraced the bill in the first place. And that is, as long as you have a single percentage apply to the first sample, you will, in effect, every now and then, occasionally, allow a measure to go on the ballot that does not contain the constitutionally required number of signatures. And there is absolutely nothing that can be done to prevent that from happening, whether you've litigated or whether you do anything you can possibly, but if you have a requirement that the single statistical estimated sample of 2% or 3% or whatever that number happens to be, which isn't identified in the measure, is the threshold for acceptance, and you have, in fact, more duplication than that that would reduce it below the constitutional minimum requirement, there's no way to repair it. There is no second sample if it passes the first sample. And if there are additional signatures added, so be it. But the issue rises with the question of the sample and whether or not you have determined and identified whether or not that petition has X number of duplications. What's interesting about the Dash 1 amendments is there's now a demonstration on the part of the Secretary that they are capable of determining the individual duplication rate on a petition, particularly as it applies to a second sample, either as a result of second signature submittal or as a result of prior to rejection. So all I can tell you is the initial reason that we came in support of the bill has been removed. And so we'll have to withdrawing our support.
Well, first of all, Mr. Phelps, I just got these today.
I'm explaining circumstances. I'm
not defensive about it at all. I'm trying to explain to you. I saw them today, too. Now that I've had a chance to read this language, I understand the concern. Because what the Secretary of State was talking to me about was a concern about internal validity within the world of a single set of petitions or the world of all the petitions, that there has to be some sort of validity among those. I understand that. But as I read the language here, the language is too vague to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me, Mr. Chairman, that we need to have some more precise language worked out to get there. I don't know what the position is on the rest of these changes. How did you feel about the not reporting on occupation and not reporting on...
We're fine, Mr. Chair. I was reacting to the tax one.
Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that maybe we could invite Mr. Phelps to work with the Secretary of State's office and me to... Because I appreciate his expertise to come up with some revised language here. I understood their goal, but now that I understand his critique, I think his critique is well-made, well-presented.
Mr. Kelson, would you be willing to do that?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. And we'll look forward to some more amendments to the bill. Mr. Williams?
Nothing, Mr. Chairman. Only if we're going to have this go back, I just, that seems sound right.
Can I have an informal poll, Mr. Chairman, about the business of not requiring the occupation and not requiring a cumulative total? Because I don't want to fight that battle. It seems to me that there's no need to be reporting a person's occupation and why we have to go into their privacy that far. Or why we should require some people who don't use computer systems for their reporting to go back and check to make sure they got the same person's name every time the right to do the cum just because somebody else wants to know what it is. Because there is no contribution limit that you're violating because there can't be a contribution limit. There was a reason for the cum before when there were limits on contribution. There's no reason for it now other than to make it a colorful thing to be able to print that so-and-so gave X dollars.
Mr. Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could Representative Mannix perhaps clarify that I know the aggregate portion of it is part of Measure 9. Do you remember if pre-existing Measure 9 we did any aggregate?
My recollection, if I may, Mr. Chairman, is that we did. My vague recollection.
Further questions, Mr. Williams?
I tend to support the proposal to eliminate requiring some personal information. And I know I got a pretty good database of supporters out there that some of them just refuse. I mean, a big share of them. They would certainly appreciate not having to put some of that down. They just think it's unnecessary, and you have to go back, call them, and try that stuff out. And it's just, I don't think it's necessary.
Christine Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I would think in some of those areas that it might be possible to pass something that had some limitations on it that could be acceptable to a majority member of the committee or without objection. But a wide open, no aggregate, no occupation, probably going to need opposition.
The actual kind of unlimited version would work.
Here's the public hearing process, and what I would like to do is offer, and I appreciate your willingness to work on some more amendments to this bill. We have two people signed up to testify today. We have Dan Meek and Jeannie Berg-Rimple. And I would offer you the opportunity to come back and test them when we get some more refined amendments to the bill, if that would work for you. Mr. Meek? One little point I'd like to make, well, then come forward and we'll try to make it very quickly so we can move on here today.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk today. I think we concur.
Your name, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Jeannie Bergruffle, and I represent Service Employees International Union. We represent about 28,000 both public and private sector employees in the state of Oregon. And in SBA, we've had considerable discussion around this. I, as a part of SEIU, ran the campaigns to qualify measures 62 and 63 this last year. So I'm fairly familiar with the initiative process of signature gathering in particular. And I think I understand where Representative Mannix had you folks are trying to go with the statistical sampling and the changes that you want to get there. And if that part of the bill we don't have any problem with. In fact, we're supportive of what you're trying to accomplish in making that process more accurate. But we do oppose the changes in Section 2. And that, of course, has to do with the aggregate and the occupation. And I know to some folks it does seem like trying to ask for occupation, but I'm one of those people that likes to pore over CNEs for hours and hours, and I actually buy those summary books. And for me to know that, say, the vast majority of the supporters or the opponents of a given ballot measure happen to have been, say, of course, the ballot measures that I've been involved with, restaurant owners, or consequently on the other side, maybe public employees. You know, either way, I think that's something that the public likes to know, and I think that helps us analyze initiatives in general and analyze each individual initiative. To me, it is important to know that those contributions came from a certain sector of society that has a certain interest, and occupation tells us something about that. Well, I also like to know the aggregate. I know that I can also get out a calculator and add that up myself when I'm looking at a CNE, so that's not as crucial to me, even though I think it's important as the occupation.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Matt?
I guess I should be careful with the numbers like the two. The cumulative would be going back and trying to figure out the amount given by each person and showing that. Mm-hmm. Aggregate would be the totaling when you're doing the summary sheet, trying to show what, and I'm more open to
saying. I got the nomenclature wrong then.
Let's put the aggregate in because that helps show where the flow is on total contributions to the campaign.
Right.
The cumulative, the problem some of us see is I get a contribution from John Q. Smith.
Mm-hmm.
I get another contribution from J. Smith. I get another one from J. Period Q. Period Smith. Sure, you can try to compare addresses or whatever else. You're trying to make sure you're tracking them properly. And you might miss. And if you've missed, you just violated the law and you didn't give the proper cumulative. So there are complications there in trying to track individuals, at least for those who don't have a computerized system. And it seems to me that, I mean, you can see who gave and where they live and just track that. And we have these interesting little rules for how you distinguish between husband and wife, depending on who signed the check.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it gets kind of ludicrous. And that's one of my objections in the system. Did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I think where I was going is, I mean, I can look at a CNE of someone who looks at the credit and see John Smith, John Q, John Miss, and the address, and figure out for myself that John Somebody Smith gave X amount by adding them together. And, well, I think we generally like to see that cumulative. It's not as important to me as seeing the occupation, because the occupation tells me more about the interest group around a measure than the numbers which I can add up myself.
This is Devin.
But at the same time, for contributions below $50 and 1 cent, we don't require you to report the name, the occupation, who it's coming from. You know, obviously, I think you still have to have the information on record.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but, and that figure, I think, was set a long time ago. $50 doesn't go as far in a campaign in 1998 or in 2000 as it did probably when that was put into place. I find the realistic, this is internal politics, this mm-hmm. is, the realistic problem is that you have an event, you got 100 people come to the event at $60 a head, you plead that they put down their occupations on their check and on their entry, you end up at the end of the event, you got 25 people that haven't, so you spend about 16 or 18 hours volunteer time over the next 2 or 3 days, versus sending out letters to every one of them, trying to get the occupations. And you start to wonder what real public purpose is fulfilled. And that's just a comment like Representative Manick.
Happy to make some of those phone calls with you. I know that it is something of a bookkeeping nightmare. It is something that you have to have spend time on. I still think it's important as someone who analyzes the CMEs from a probably different perspective of wanting to see who's really behind what and what they're really after. I like having the occupation there. I think it's important. I know it's a pain having chased it down. And so I guess my comment is I acknowledge what you're saying there and know that that's kind of a pain, but I still think it serves a purpose in reporting.
Thank you for coming to answer the question.
Thank you.
Mr. Meek? Again, won't be moving the bill today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I frequently travel out of the state and may not be available at the next time this bill comes up. Just 3 points. First, I'm Dan Meek. I represent the Coalition for Initiative Rights. Number one, we agree with Mr. Phelps on the duplication issue. That is, you need to apply an individualized approach to duplicates for each set of signatures submitted on both samples, or it doesn't make any sense. Second, as we testified on April 9th, we very much oppose the provision in this bill that deletes the requirement for recording of the occupation of a contributor. This is a severe erosion even of the pre-Measure 9 campaign finance disclosure requirements. It serves a very important public purpose of allowing people to know where the money is coming from. We have the examples of restaurateurs. There are infinite number of examples. For example, let's say that you have a bill that somehow regulates the securities industry. You could easily have contributions, hundreds or even thousands of contributions from individuals who work in the securities industry and not have any idea where and no one can find out where these contributions are coming from or who is funding them unless people are required to report their occupations. I would point out also that existing Oregon law on this is probably too weak because it doesn't require the campaign to actually report the contributions of contributors. It only requires that they ask for the occupation and send a letter or otherwise contact the contributor if that information about occupation is not provided. On deleting the aggregate number, I think that Representative Vanek means the cumulative number for each individual contributor. That would be fine as long as reporting were allowed and the results of reporting were made available electronically, as is required by Measure 64, but Measure 64 has been enjoined by the courts and is not in effect. As long as persons could obtain the reports in electronic form, it wouldn't be a problem to determine the aggregate or cumulative contribution of any individual. As it is now, with everything done on paper,
it would be very difficult to figure that out and time-consuming. So I would tie that into electronic reporting. Finally, one thing that I've learned in dealing with the Internet is the value of potentially having a contributor handle. For example, if you ever register a domain name, you'll find that you're given an Internet handle. Mine is DM914. All transactions that I do with domain names in the Internet, I never have to identify my name, address, email address, phone number, anything else. I'm just DM914. Perhaps we should have political contributor handles. You simply register once with the Secretary of State, and then whenever you make a contribution, just indicate what your handle is, and no one has to ask you what your occupation is or your address or anything else, because it's in a central database.
I think that's where he was going.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Question for Mr. Meek.
Mr. Chairman, I just want it on the record that I want everybody to know that if you go to that system, I'm already declaring reservations on Big Cheese as my people.
Mr. Chairman,
this is Devlin.
Just for the record on this, mm-hmm. I think sometimes, you know, the example's been given here of somebody and a multiple number of people from the same profession contributing to one candidate. Well, I think many of us have the example, without mentioning names of organizations, where we've had multiple contributions from members of organizations, and the organizations have political action committees, and we've never had a contribution from the political action committee. So a lot of times when individuals are making contributions, individual contributions, they're not making them on the basis of their association with their group. They may be making it on the basis of how you feel about public funding of schools, how you feel about criminal justice issues. Assuming that somebody makes a $100 contribution with the realtor to a candidate on realtor issues, is it just as false an assumption as some of the other assumptions in this process?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes,
Senator Devlin. Mm-hmm. Our main interest, of course, is ballot measures. And that's, you mentioned candidates. Is on ballot measures, it's very important to know the source of the funding and the occupation of those who are contributing the amounts, I believe. It may be less important in Canada's elections, but certainly for ballot measures, people need to know where the money is coming from. Thank you.
This is Matt. Having been co-chief petitioner on a number of ballot measures, I feel sensitive to the fact that our supporters also have to identify their occupation on the petition, and it's a two-edged sword. So the Coalition for Initiative Rights may want to see what the opponents of the initiative, where they're coming from, but the opponents want to see where the proponents are coming from. And I guess everybody likes to know where everybody works, and I'd like to give everybody a little bit of privacy, so I guess it's a different perspective.
Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 363 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1178. Vicki Urban. Yes,
Mr. Morris, to give an overview. Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 1178 revised election laws to accommodate conduct of biennial primary and general elections by mail, allows up to 5,000 registered voters to be included in the precinct, allows voter registration to be updated after 21st day before the election, without a personal appearance at the county clerk's office, decreases the percentage of precincts required to be on nominating petition for candidates filing by petition, defines an absent elector, deletes requirements for making available limited fail-safe ballot, codifies election by mail provisions, includes other revisions of administrative nature.
Please identify yourself for the record and jump right in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Vicki Urban, and I'm the Director of Elections for Multnomah County. I'm here today also in representation of the Oregon Association of County Clerks. Senate Bill 1178 is a compilation of changes that are being proposed by the Oregon Association of County Clerks. The bill came about because of the passage of Ballot Measure 60 at the last general election. Although no statutory changes are required in order to conduct primary and general elections by mail, it being prudent to review and simplify the statutes so that they reflected the new legislation. Also, several of the sections of this bill were originally in our omnibus bill, but we pulled them out and put them in this bill so they could be drafted in the context of the overall changes that we're proposing. Generally, you got a good summary from your committee administrator, but the bill does the following. It divides Chapter 254 into three sections for the sheer conduct of elections generally, conduct of elections at polling places, and conduct of elections by mail. It creates a definition of absent elector. It deletes the requirement for the limited fail-safe ballot. It increases the maximum size of precincts from 2,000 to 5,000. It changes the process for registration updates after the 21st day before the election. And it puts into statute the mailed election provisions that are now defined by administrative rule. This is a long and comprehensive bill, so I prepared a section by section in order to help describe the bill in detail. I will go through that section by section if, Mr. Chair, it's your pleasure.
Members of the committee, what's your pleasure?
Chair, questions for Ms. Urban? Yes?
Are we going to get a section by section
analysis?
We have one
in front of us. Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, just a general question. House Bill 2001 is that the right number? But it's not come back to this committee, I believe, yet for a final vote. But it has all the amendments that it's going to have. Do you know if there's any conflict between this and 2001?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, there's no conflict per se. There is only one place that I see that ours is even a little more stringent, and it has to do with the number of voting booths that are required.
Mm.
In 2001, your number of required voting booths for a county that had less than 35,000 was one, and in ours we said any place that you issue ballots, you must have at least three voting booths, which is consistent with the number of voting booths that are required at a polling place now. That's why we chose three. So that's the only place I can see where we would require three. You said one. We would require a minimum of three. You required more than that for bigger counties.
Mr. Chair, I will clarify on the record and admit my error. I didn't remember that we had passed it out of the committee already. We've done so many bills but are we sure that there is no conflict between these two?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, yep, that was one of the things that I was particularly interested in because I wanted to make sure that this was all consistent with the changes that you've made in 2001, and I don't think we'll find that there's any problem.
Representative Maddox.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to double check. I'm kind of commenting on the representative back here. When I get a bill that's complicated, my first litmus test is whether or not my county clerk called me any time in the last 4 months or wrote to me and said, ooh, there's something, because Al Davidson in my county is very careful about reviewing this stuff from his perspective and then giving me some feedback. And the good news is that I have not heard from him, so I assume that's good news. And frankly, I would have heard from him very loudly if there was a problem. My question is, the Association of County Courts has supported this. Are there any county courts out there that are saying they have, separate from the philosophical issue, but in terms of the nuts and bolts, are there any folks out there that are saying this is bad, we've got a problem here in terms of the nuts and bolts?
Mr. Chair, Representative Manning, not that I have heard. Now, we've been in discussion about this for obviously a number of months, ever since Ballot Measure 60 passed. We discussed it at our midwinter conference this year. We've discussed it many times at our legislative meeting to make sure that everybody had adequate input and knowledge of the various things that are in here. And there has not been any objection that has been raised to any of that.
Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to first thank the County Clerks Association for the hard work they've done in trying to clean this up. I think it's a very admirable process. And I've just done my quick perusal of the 67 sections of this bill, and the brief summary, and just to echo the statement by Representative Mannix, so the Washington County Clerk's Office is very active in this process. I'm confident if they would have had a problem with the bill, I would have heard both from them and the lobbyists for Washington County as well. And frankly, Mr. Chairman, after my review of those 67 sections, I'm ready to make a motion once you come into work session.
I think he's asking to carry the bill, Mr.
Yeah. Chairman.
I have mine for the day, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Further questions or comments? My witness?
I'm not with you.
We're
on fire. We have to be notified if we decide to move the
bill. We know. We can vote.
Do we need it?
We have, he wanted to come down and vote on it. So we'll
on this bill?
Yes.
So we're calling him in.
We're calling him right now. Mm-hmm. Representative Byer.
Well, while we're waiting, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Maddox.
I, too, would like to compliment the association on what they've done.
I do think it speaks well of the work that they've done. At, if there were speakers, we would hear about them. This took a lot of meticulous work. So here the groundwork, I believe, helps the bill fail.
What we can do then is close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 1178. And Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 1178 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Colleagues, I have a motion before us to move Senate Bill 1178 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections?
Well, my clerk says thumbs up.
Yeah, Representative Byer should be here momentarily, so just skip him for now. Go ahead and call the roll.
Representative Edison?
Excuse.
Representative Beck?
Aye.
Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Excuse.
Representative Carter?
Aye.
Representative May?
Aye.
Representative Tucci?
Aye.
Representative Starr?
Excuse.
Representative Welch?
Aye.
Aye. And we'll hold the vote open until Representative Byer gets here. This is the last piece of...
Do you mean until the chair of the bill gets here, Mr. Chair?
Yeah. That's why you want to be here, wouldn't
you? You want to hear it? Yes.
There he is.
Mr. Byer.
How do you vote?
On 1178.
All right.
This is Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, if Representative Byer doesn't want to carry the bill, I'll carry the bill. It appears members don't like to ask me questions on the floor about bills, so...
You all the Devlin, you may think quicker that way. But if Representative Byer would like to defer to Representative Devlin, we'll assign Representative Devlin as the carrier.
So is I carrying this bill?
I only have 50 or something.
I see the star's name on the top of it. President Devlin, he wants to carry the bill, he's more than welcome.
Okay, well, sign Representative Devlin as the carrier, and House Bill 1178, Bill 1178 is moved to the floor to do pass recommendation, and if you know other business for the committee, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you.